Hanging on now for a couple of seconds to make sure it's working.
Yeah.
I never know with this.
Well, now that's about all I know about the beginning. The strike was really against the shipyards, and of course they tried to unionize everything, you know. That was the beginning of it. And the shipyards were all unionized. Not all the men were in favor of unions, because remember, it was the beginning of the unions, or more or less the beginning. It was kind of an unknown quantity. And when we had that union, now I can't tell you the actual dates, because dates mean nothing to me. The first thing that affected me was that my husband said that sometimes he might not be home at night, and he could let me know he would. But that if they found that the unions were going to have a demonstration against the Blanche in some of these places where they wouldn't be unionized, the men working in the store had to stay, because they had built great big board covers for their show windows. And you see, they went from Pike to Union on Second Avenue. That was the main drag then. And they didn't seem to look. Frederick's and the other stores, they didn't seem to be working too hard on. So he said that if something happened, the men would have to help get those things together and so forth and so forth. Well, they notified us that we could have no milk delivered. We could get no milk for our babies unless we went after it and had an order from the doctor. Well, my doctor was in Seattle. So I went in town and went to Dr. Sharpless' office. He was our family doctor, took care of the baby and so forth. Marianne was about a year old then, something like that. We lived on 5th, Northeast, and 50th. East 50th, I think it was. It was in the University District. And we traveled back and forth mostly by streetcar, but there were jitneys. For 5 cents, you could ride to town in a car, 5 people in a car, you know. And that was a lot faster than streetcar. So I went to town and went to see Dr. Sharpless. It was in the morning, and his office girl said, "Well, you go on in, he's busy on the phone now, but he'll be there." And he carried out this conversation. "Yes, yes, yes, I'll agree to that. Yes, we'll do that. Yes, yes." And then he put it down, and he says, "I'm so damn mad with some other work before and after." He said, "I don't know what to do. The unions say that if the jitneys continue to run, they'll strew tax on the street because of the tires on the car." And he said the doctors and the undertakers have gotten together. He was talking to Dr. Richard O'Shea, who was the head baby doctor in town. They were both very prominent men. And he said if they strew the tax on the street to stop our using our cars, all the doctors and undertakers in Seattle are lined up, and they'll not service any of the union men. He said, we may be able to break it that way. Well, he gave me my little card that said I could get, and I had this child so old, so old, so far. I could get milk for her, but now we lived on 50th. On 5th, and I had to go clear up the university district, rain or shine. 45th and university to get my milk, and I had to go after it myself. Well, I had to take the baby out in that rain. I had no one to go with or do stuff all the time. So I went a couple of times. And you stood in line with all these mothers, some of them with how I kids, you know. And then my neighbor, who was also my friend, her husband worked in the shipyards, but he was a union member, but that was all. And she said that some of the men there had decided that they would gather several cars and go and take care of milk for various ones in their neighborhood. And they got permission from the union to do that, so they got the milk. Then this thing went on. I was getting kind of itchy. I wanted to see what went on downtown, you know. And so my neighbor said she'd take care of the baby if I wanted to go. So I went to town. The streetcars weren't running by that time, you see. And on that street corner, there'd be groups of men collecting. Policemen come up moving, static. They wanted no groups of people to gather on the street. I suppose you probably know why. I suppose it was a prevention. And so I went into the barn, went upstairs to see my husband. I'd been told to stay home, you see. But I was curious, and I was young. He was very indignant, and he told me to stay away from the window, that something was going to break. They didn't know what it was, but something was going to break. So his office was on the second floor, and the window was there, and there were window shades, and up, you know, and then the window shades came to bottom up. And we were sitting there talking about the thing, and he was scolding me, and I just did as I pleased, you know. And we heard this commotion up the street, up towards Storage Street. And we both of us stuck our heads out to the window to look. And here coming up 2nd Avenue was a streetcar, just bristling with soldiers top, and all the windows were armed with guns and a great big American flag up on top. And the people along the way in the stores and everybody were hurrahing for it, you know. And these people all just disappeared. Jitneys went to work, streetcars were on duty. Now, the town, I think, was under military law for 2 or 3 days. But now, I may be mistaken about that, but it was the soldiers who came in, and they had brought them in to the old armory that was, I think, at the foot of Stewart Street in the Sound. And they brought them in by boat from Tacoma, where they were, Port Louis, you see. And they landed in the night, and at a given time in the morning, they manned a streetcar. And they went down 2nd Avenue, the thing was all over. I could have gone home on a streetcar. But was a real thrill. I don't know why I've had such a thrill. But that was the end of that thing, although of course it was the end of the strike. They were very powerful and have been always in Seattle, I think. Now, I'm not against the unions now, but in those days, I felt that we were being pushed around. You see, it was the beginning. They do a lot of good, but the men at the head of it then were a bunch of bullies, you see. And they just thought they could just shove their way through them. And that's just about all that I know about it. But now I ran against the union two or three times afterward. We moved up on the 17th and 70th. That was probably, 7 or 8 years after this. And I got bread from the Sunshine Bakery, made wonderful, almost homemade bread, and the driver of the cup was a little Canadian young man. He had a wife and a baby, he used to tell me about it, you know. And he came in one day and he was just as white as a sheet, and I said, "What's wrong with you? Are you sick?" "No," he said, "they've been following me again." "Who's been following you?" "Those two big bruisers in that car." And it seems that they picked him up when he left the bakery, and they followed him just about a half a block. When he stopped, they stopped. When he stopped, they stopped, you see. He was a Canadian. And they were pulling that just thing then, that he had to be an American to work here. Well, I gave him some coffee, and in a little while, he went on out and went on down, and I saw this car. And the next day it was there, and they stopped right in front of our garage. I couldn't have gotten out if I wanted to. And he came in, and he didn't know what had happened to him. It was about three times the size of him. He was a little slight man like you are, you know, and he didn't want to get into trouble. And it made me so mad, I couldn't have gotten my car out if I wanted to. But I went down and I backed the car out almost into their car, and I said, "What are you doing here? Are you the man that are bullying this young man who's delivering my toast or my bread?" And he said, "Yes." "Well," I said, "if you park here again, I'll call the police because you're parking in a private place as a private driver." And they blustered a bit, and they went on, but they didn't come after him again. I think from what he said, two or three people had done like this. But you see, they were just trying to bully their way through. And they were great big bruisers, these men. And I was coming from 1947-48. I was coming north from California, and I got into Centralia, and there was something wrong with my car. And I asked the gas station man where I could get it fixed. He told me what it was, but he couldn't tell me. And just before you left Centralia, no, it was Chehalis. Centralia is the first place. Just before you left Chehalis, there was this Ford agency there. They had a door in the corner. Now he said, "There's some, I think that they're being picketed, I don't know, for something that they've done that wasn't approved." But he said, "You can try that. I wouldn't go too far with your car that way." So I went up there, and here these two great big bullies were standing in the door, and I could see the men inside just standing around doing nothing. The door to their garage, their shop, was open. So I got up and drove up there and stopped, and I went around to go into the into the office or the showrooms, I suppose you'd call it, to see about having something having done to the car, what had to be done. And these two men just stepped in front of me and went, well, let me go in and go. And I thought, well, please me, I go through. Well, you can't go in there, they're picketed. Well, I said, you can't keep me from going. And the one man started to put his hand down on me. I said, you touch me, I'll call the police. Well, I went in, I got the car fixed, but it was the office man who fixed it. But now this is a pick on a woman all by herself, you know. It just isn't right. I don't think they do that kind of thing now. But various of my friends had some examples. Hello.
Huh? When I don't want to stop you.
Well, I've told about all I know, one thing. One of my who done it. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. My youngest daughter's husband worked on a newspaper with a journalist graduate university. And he accepted a position at Fairbanks, Alaska. And he'd been here without a job for a while. And so they had two little children. I think Stephen was about six and Mary Kay was probably four or something like that. And they were to take this Alaska steamship that went to Anchorage and then take the train to Fairbanks from Anchorage. And the morning they were to sail, Stephen broke out the spots, hit that chicken pox. And that meant 2 weeks quarantine in those days, and you were quarantined, I believe me. Jerry cares. And Jerry wanting his job so bad, so they decided that he'd go on and he'd follow with the two kids when she goes. Well, of course, Stephen was about a day or so older when Mary Kay gave out the spots, and it was all of a month. Life was kind of hectic, my house, because those two kids wanting their daddy and knowing where and all about. So she had reservations to go on this vessel at a given time, a given day. We passed the United States immigration, or the quarantine, whoever the medical pastor, because Stephen was all over by that time, so was Mark Kane, but she had one little spot that wouldn't seem to heal. And our doctor passed her, and the city health doctor passed her. So they were all ready to go, and the things kept coming because of the trouble they'd had before. Sent a limousine out for us to go down to the vessel to go. And that morning they announced that the stewards on the vessel wouldn't service a stateroom with chickenpox. But the child was over the chickenpox. Well, Jade hit the ceiling. And she wired Jerry that she couldn't come and so forth. And then the steamship company got busy and made plane reservations for her. Well, in the meantime, some friends called to say goodbye to Jade before she left, and I told them what was going on. Jersey Times, Russell McGrath. And so she called Russell, and he sent a young reporter out to talk to Dave what happened. And it was somebody that Jane had gone to school with. So they could do nothing. They couldn't even publish that. But they were building up a portfolio of incidents, you see. She got off all right with the plane, and that was the end of that. But now that was just plain bullheadedness, you know, and ignorance. Because the government had passed her. Our city health had passed her. Our doctor had passed her. And she'd gone to have her hair washed and cut before she left, and the barber had worked on her. But they just were disagreeable. And that was the last ship that ever went to Alaska then. Then everybody had to go by plane for a long time. But they, in those days, it just seemed to, it was just plain force. They thought they could bully their way through everything, you know, and they found out they couldn't. Now I think they're very more intelligent than the people who are running this thing up. Dave Beck's son went to Roosevelt High School, and they had an awful time with him. He'd get so trouble, he wouldn't work, and the teachers couldn't do anything with him. His father was head of the union, they let him go. People are probably very peculiar. That's about all I know about the union.
Now,
what do you want to ask me?
Let me start from before the strike, and maybe a lot of the background things that you told me, I don't think the tape was on yet.
No, I was putting my hearing aid on that
loud. So, maybe we go back to the very beginning, some things that the tape missed. Okay. Why don't we start by you telling me where and when you were born, how you came to Seattle.
Huh?
Can you tell me where and when you were born and how you came to Seattle?
I was born in Peru, Indiana. Well, 90 years ago, whatever that. 2nd of December.
And when did you come to Seattle?
In 1917. I was married in 1913. In Richmond, Indiana. I went to school in Richmond, Indiana. Graduated Richmond High School. Went to Earlham College off and on. Earlham College is Quaker College, but you've probably been the East, you know. And my husband's father owned a dry goods store. He worked in that.
And then you came out together Seattle.
Yes, uh-huh.
Why was that? Why did you come to Seattle?
Why? Because my husband had been here during the time of the fair, and he didn't want to go back to Richmond live, although he did. He had a cousin who worked at the bond, was a manager there, and he could always get a job, so he had a job. And we moved to Seattle. I knew when, long before we were married, that we'd end up in Seattle. Because I knew how he was. I'd known him all through high school.
So he came to the bond and worked as a buyer there?
Yes, he worked in the bond all the years he did here, all the years he lived.
Uh-huh. What did your folks do?
My father was an ice man. He had a nice factory, home business. They run together, you know. And he had several ponds where he cut natural ice to use for refrigeration purposes. He had a nice factory. My brother went to Purdue University and was a mechanical engineer. He worked assassinated people during the war, the First World War. And then when he died, he was running a machine shop in Lafayette, Indiana, where they made ornamental iron. And I think his sons are running, one of his sons is running right now.
Do you remember when you were, either when you were growing up, or when you were growing up, was politics discussed at home?
Oh, my people were Democrats here. Born and bred Democrats.
So did they talk about politics a lot?
Of course. Of course, all men talk politics. Grandfather talked politics. My husband talked politics.
So when your children were growing up, you also talked politics at home?
No, we never talked politics. We just looked at them and read their views and they got heated up over it.
So was it then the men talked politics but the women didn't?
It was even in family gatherings and like that, that the men would get together and talk politics.
Uh-huh, but the women didn't talk politics?
No, we didn't vote. Oh, women didn't have friends enough to vote in those days.
when you came to Seattle, maybe you tell me a little about what it was like then. It must have been very different than it is now.
What?
Seattle must have been very different.
Oh, what city? Seattle was just a big overgrown town. And Princess Angela sat on the pavement outside of Frederick's store on 2nd Avenue and sold baskets.
I've heard that the streets weren't paved.
Oh, no, not all the streets were paved. Downtown they were paved. 45th was paved. University Way was paved. I didn't know much about the other parts of town because we didn't have a car. No, it was a country town.
Did it grow during the war? Is that what made it into a city?
Yeah, I think so. You see, they built Fort Lewis. Maybe it was built before that. I don't know. Anyway. There were lots of soldiers in Seattle during the First World War. My husband was not eligible for physical reasons. And there were lots of soldiers, lots of sailors. You see, they went to the shipyards. They went to Tacoma. There was a kind of whatever you call it, where the ships would be there. University probably had a dozen buildings in it. Beautiful, beautiful campus. And how many people, how many students there were there, I have no idea. It wasn't a great big university, although it was one of the first universities on the West Coast.
Let me ask you a little about the strike. Do you remember why it was called?
No.
When you first heard about it, when you first heard that it was going to be called, what did you expect it to be like? Did you think it was going to be a revolution?
Really, I didn't think it would affect me at all. You see, we were about 12 miles from downtown. The shipyards were south of that. Really, it never entered my head. I was too interested in my home and my little one, and, you know, that kind of thing.
So it didn't seem, for instance, only Hanson, the mayor, said he thought it was going to be a revolution. That it didn't seem You weren't afraid that that was going to happen?
Oh, I wasn't afraid. No, maybe I had sense enough to be afraid. No, I wasn't afraid.
What did you think it was going to be like having the whole city closed?
Well, I don't know that I'm even worried about that. We have a garden. I was worried more about milk for the baby than anything else. My husband got his lunches downtown.
Did he eat in one of the big kitchens that the strikers set up?
Oh no, he wasn't in the strike. He worked at the barn, you see.
And so the barn.
They always had a tea room, and they had an employee dining room.
So the barn wasn't on strike during the strike.
No, the barn, just the clerks wouldn't vote against the strike. You see, they come in, apparently. They say they come in here. A union man comes in and talks. They have to get permission. Clerks had voted for the union. Of course, the administration would have nothing to do with that. But the clerks themselves voted against it. You see, the idea of the union was that a so-called labor man belonged to unions. And the department store men were a step or so above the laboring men. You see what I mean. There's always been the strata. There is now. They won't admit it, but it's there.
So they voted against going out on strike?
Yeah, so.
This is just a side thought. Did your husband know Beck? I think his name was.
No, we had no contact with any of those people. He read the papers, and he heard talk downtown and like that, and then it was not his nature to join a union.
What papers did you read at home? What
newspapers? The Times.
The Times.
And the PI in the morning. Times in the evening. My husband picked it up at the Montmartre door, ready coming home on the streetcar.
But not the union record?
Huh?
Do you remember the union record?
We never had one, but the union record was out, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Did your husband know not Beck the union man, but Beck the manager of the Beaumont?
Yes, he did very well.
I was just reading last week in the library some reports that Beck had, the manager had certain labor spies who went around and talked to different
people. They
might
have had, I don't know.
But
I don't remember hearing it. You see, now listen, that Beck, who was supposed to be high up in the Bar-Maché, was the son-in-law of one of the owners of the Bar-Maché, and he was around and thought he was very important for a while, but he didn't know a thing about what he meant. He went away from here, and he went to Filene's in Boston, and worked for Filene, and learned the merchandise, and then he came back here. But that time, he was ready to take over certain branches of the business. But when he first came into the store, he was the boss's son-in-law, and he could be just as he can pleased. His wife was a very nice person. He was always nice.
Do you remember remember when the strike started, who called it?
I would remember that.
Uh-huh. Do you remember how you got your information about the strike?
Newspapers.
Was there a time when the newspapers weren't being printed?
Uh-huh.
Was there a time when the newspapers stopped being printed during the strike?
No, I remember of, and I think I would remember that.
Uh-huh. You were telling me before about when the Army came in. Did you feel at the time the Army was needed?
Hmm?
Was the Army needed when it came in? Was there violence or...
No, there wasn't. The Army didn't have to do anything. All these men who were the Union men who were circulating around town, and they had no use for the Army. And they also knew that the Army was above them, that they were their woolly people trying to make them go. They pushed women off the curb. A woman would stand on the curb to wait to cross the street. And one of these fellows come up and want to be ahead, and he'd push her, you know. Oh, they were a bunch of roughnecks.
So then was the Army needed to keep them in line?
Well, the Army was only here 2 or 3 days.
Uh-huh.
It was the guns that scared them.
So you think that the Army was important in ending the strike?
I think the Army ended it.
Uh-huh. In what way do you think they ended it?
Well, they came in the town, and all the men around, all the Union men in downtown, the town was full of Union men downtown. There were very few women on the street. And just the fact that they knew the Army was there.
Uh-huh.
It's the same effect that a bunch of policemen would have, only more so if a bunch of kids began to act up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They knew they had superior authority. They knew they had probably more strength.
Do you remember seeing the labor guard, that is the people who the unions had decided would act as sort of policemen but without guns? Did you see them around at all?
Oh, I didn't know that the labor men carried weapons at all.
No, I say the labor guard didn't carry weapons,
no.
But acted as policemen.
The policemen carried a willy.
Uh-huh.
They might have carried guns, I don't know.
Uh-huh, but you didn't see these Union policemen around during
no.
the strike? Uh-huh.
What do you mean by Union policemen?
Well, the unions, when they declared the strike, decided that they would take some veterans who were Union men and make them, they called the labor guard. They didn't carry weapons, but they went around and told people not to group up in the streets. And
no, those were regular police downtown.
Uh-huh. Did you think the strike was worth it for the unions?
No, I don't think so. They were interfering with people's liberties, our American principles. Not that they had no right to join unions. But they shouldn't try to force other people to do what we have a right of free thought in this country. We always have had. And that's what they were trying to get away with, was just trying to make people afraid so they'd join the union. And remember, those union men paid great big fees into the union, too. Percentage of, I don't know what it was, but I know it was enough.
So,
now listen, I'm not against the unions, but it's just the observation I made when I was a young woman.
Uh-huh. Did you feel then that the strike hurt the union movement at the time, or did it help it, or?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that it even bothers me to think about it.
Do you remember what people were saying about the unions at that time? What were your friends?
My friends were university people, and people belonging to the University Presbyterian Church, like that. And we didn't discuss unions.
You didn't discuss the general strike when it was happening?
It happened, and we had to accept it, but we had all the food we wanted and everything. But we didn't have milk for our babies. And then that's where they struck, you see. And that's where they got the mothers and the housewives to give them. Because they struck at the babies.
So, would you say that your biggest memory of the strike is the milk?
I think the milk, yes.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Sharpless' observation about the tax on the street.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I went downtown, I was just curious to see what was happening, you know. Also, my husband told me to stay home.
Did you know Ole Hansen? Do you remember him?
Yeah, I remember Ole Hansen. I didn't know him, no.
What do you remember about him?
I just knew he was Ole Hansen. He was the mayor of Seattle.
Uh-huh. How about Anna Louise Strong? Do you remember her? Anna Louise Strong?
The name... No, I don't know anything about it, except that the name strikes up.
Uh-huh. How about Jimmy Duncan?
No, don't know anything about him.
Did you know any people in the IWW? Any Wobblies?
In the what?
The IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World.
No, I don't think I did.
Uh-huh.
I don't think they were very strong at that time. And I think the unions were trying probably to make them strong. You see, that's all more or less after the Second World War. The Industrial Workers of the World. Isn't it?
I don't know. Out
there. I think so.
Uh-huh.
You see, the First World War, was the first time, shall I say, since the Revolution, that America stood equal with England and France. We stood ahead of Italy, we stood ahead of Belgium. I read these big print books, and a lot of them are, the first ones were all English publications. We're getting some American publications now. I mean, American publishers are putting them out. And quite a few of them are about the time of the war. Their idea of the Americans, except a few people from New York and Boston who went over, was a bunch of roughnecks, a bunch of clodhoppers, a bunch of uneducated people, and they had their ideas changed. It all comes out in these books, and it's been rather amusing. I didn't know that I'd ever apply it to anything like this, but that's the way it is.
What do you think, what have been the major events that have happened that you've seen since the time of the strike?
Well, I think the administration, he was such a rubber, and it all came out of paper. And the Roosevelt family, of course, now And he had been in the army, and during the Spanish American War, and he came home as an army officer. But he was one of the people. He liked people. People liked him. He came through Richmond on a tour he was making. And I couldn't get downtown to hear him talk. I mean, I couldn't go that particular time, so I went down to the railroad station thinking I might see. And here are the back platform of this train going through, and hardly anybody in the station. And here was this one or two women standing there. I was just a girl, I guess. And he took off this cowboy hat. He made a great big, "How do you do, ladies? How are you?" And as he went off. But that was the kind of a person he was. Then Franklin came along. I would say what I think about Franklin. That's not far from excessive.
But you think that was an important event when Franklin Roosevelt was president? I think that was one of the important events in the country or in the world since the strike?
I think that Franklin Roosevelt left the country morally in a much worse condition than he found it.
Why do you say that?
Well, he had his lady friends around. It used to make the women so mad. Let there be an important person as a guest, the White House. And they'd all be lined up having their pictures taken. And here would be Franklin, and here would be Mama, and here would be an important person. Way out here on the end of the line would be Eleanor. That made the women awful mad. Now that's a woman's five. I know it's funny to you, but it isn't funny either.
Any other events that you think of as major events?
I don't. I should be able to think, but I don't.
Was there anything that happened after the strike, as a result of the strike, that you could see?
No, I don't remember anything. The shipyards were so busy, you see, they worked around the clock. And I wasn't near the shipyard, you see, they were here down in South Seattle. Frankly, I wasn't particularly interested. I didn't know enough to be interested.
What sorts of organizations have you belonged to in your life, either political or religious?
Well, I went to Earlham College, off and on. I went to the Art Academy at Cincinnati. I taught design and what have you in Richmond for a while. I belonged to the Art Association of Richmond, helped hang pictures and things like that. It was the first, they built a new high school there, and it was the first high school in the country that put an art gallery in their high school. And we were all very proud of it. And we had national exhibits from it. I belonged. I belonged to the Lutheran Church. My husband was a Lutheran in Richmond. When we came here, we joined the University Presbyterian Church, and I worked very hard there all those years. I was a member of the John Adelphian group way back when. I was very active in the Weaver's Guild in Seattle. I held every office for president, and I would take. Then when it came out here, I came to live. My husband had been dead several years, and I couldn't see any sense of having some other woman come living with me and so forth, which they were all after me. I lived alone, a sinful woman, live alone. And so I decided I'd come out here. I came out one day, and before I left, I had signed up. I mean, it was a garden. That was 17, 18 years ago. And when I was here, I belonged to various things in here.
Did you ever belong to any political organizations?
No, I never did.
How about your husband? I wanted to ask you before, you were talking about that the unions have always been very powerful in Seattle, in the Seattle area. Do you have any idea why that is?
Sure.
Do you have any idea why that is? Why have the unions always been so powerful?
Well, there were a good many laborers, and the all the labor class depended upon the shipyards or its associations at that time. And the labor class was a big class. I mean, group of people. I'm not speaking of class. I'm not class conscious. And their health and welfare dependent on the union for their job.
What did you think of the civil rights movement when it was happening?
I don't know that thought.
How about the student anti-war movement a couple of years ago?
That's way beyond me. I stopped reading the newspapers.
Uh-huh.
You see, I can't read small print. And I...
What do you think of the women's movement?
Well, my daughter is a very ardent. Women's rights. She writes letters to the editor, and she does all this kind of thing. And my daughter, my younger daughter, and her husband were in a newspaper in the Matanuska Valley at Palmer, Alaska. She's a business manager, and he's the editor. They have three or four. And I suppose she'd be very much for the women's rights. I always thought we could get anything we wanted without fighting for. At least that was my experience. Maybe I didn't ask too much.
And you said that you thought the labor movement today was different than it had been.
Oh, sure it is.
In what way?
I think now it considers the people that work for them. And I think in a way it's got more powerful, yeah. But I think in a way it's running out of its power. You see, the history of all movements is that they work up to a peak and they go along and then they gradually work down. And I think this is on the downward movement. Now, why I think that, I have no idea. It's probably just from associating and when people work for me and the people that meet here and things like that. Of course, most of the men we meet here are preachers, you know. Yeah. And Methodists and that, they're kind of radical.
What do you mean?
We if you aren't a Methodist, you're a heathen. Now that's just a vast exaggeration.
Well, I have no more questions that I have down. Are there any other things that you remember about the strike or about that time?
What do I remember about that?
Are there any other things that we haven't covered that you've maybe thought of?
No, I can't think of anything now. Uh-huh. And I've, since Marianne wrote, told me that she'd written to you, and then I had your note. I've tried to think of things. I can't think of anything.
You've thought of more than anyone else I've interviewed so far.
Well, I think it was probably because when Marianne was here, she quizzed me then. I didn't realize she was going to write to you about it. I thought she was just curious, because every so often we get together and I have to give them a certain amount of family history or this and that and the other thing. What time is it? Is that 4:15?
4:15.